Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Taken to the Grave by Cara Devlin, narrated by Ali Rose. Chapter 1. May 1821. The steady ticking of the long case clock was the only sound inside the study at 19 Bedford Street. Hugh Marsden sat at his desk, wishing to be anywhere but where he presently was. Two women in the chairs opposite his stared at him, each of them shifting anxiously. Their visit had been unexpected, and now he wished he'd given some excuse to turn them away. However, as one of the ladies was Lady Rebecca Poston, the beloved wife of Bow Street Chief Magistrate Sir Gabriel Poston, he had not. Hugh's curiosity as to why the magistrate's wife had come calling at such a late afternoon hour had influenced him to welcome her and her companion into his study. Not exactly a Trojan horse situation, but close enough. He drummed his fingers upon the desk and sighed. "I'm not sure I can be of any assistance, Lady Rebecca." She was several years younger than her husband, but just as formidable. The way she glared down the slope of her nose at Hugh now reminded him of when he'd been a young rapscallion, and his own mother had managed to give him a proper dressing down, with only a heavy, piercing look. He sat forward, unwilling to fold as he might have back then. "You must understand, I respect Sir Gabriel too much to go behind his back in anything."
"My niece is missing, Lord Neatham," she replied.
"And yet Sir Gabriel does not believe that to be the case," he replied. "Not only that, but you've admitted he did not want you coming here to ask me to investigate," a request she had roundly ignored. Lady Rebecca's sister, Mrs. Caroline Silas, beat her scalloped hand fan rapidly to cool her face. She was not as self-possessed as her sister, and when she spoke, it was with a tremulous warble.
"My lord, please."
The gusts from her fan tossed the ringlets framing her face.
"My daughter is in trouble. Mr. Silas and Sir Gabriel believe she has merely eloped, but I know she has not."
Hugh clenched his back teeth. "Hell. Why do they believe she has eloped?" he asked. The sisters exchanged a look. Lady Rebecca urged Mrs. Silas on with a nod.
"There is a man," she said. "Bethany is a bit wild, and she has not kept the finest company, I will admit to that. But to elope with no word, no note, leaving me to worry. No, she would not do such a thing."
Hugh kept his expression neutral, even though he wanted to groan and throw back his head in frustration. No doting mother would ever wish to believe their daughter, raised to be a perfect society lady, would fall in love with an unsuitable man, let alone run off to Gretna Green with him. "Does Mr. Silas know you are here, requesting that I investigate?" He presumed he did not, just as Sir Gabriel did not, and when Mrs. Silas shook her head, he stood from his chair. He needed to move, to think. Hugh didn't want to offend Lady Rebecca, but even more so, he didn't need to anger his last connection to his former life at Bow Street. After he'd been foisted from his role as principal officer and given instead the mantle of Viscount Neatham, Sir Gabriel had continued to involve him in several cases. However, after a handful of months last autumn, when Hugh had become somewhat of a distracted wastrel, Sir Gabriel had ceased approaching him. It had been all Hugh's own doing. When the Dowager Duchess of Fornia, Audrey Sinclair, had gone to the continent to spend the bulk of her required mourning period travelling, her letters to Hugh, and his to her, had been intercepted and collected by another private inquiry agent, one who had been hired to follow Audrey. In waylaying their correspondence, the inquiry agent had caused them both a great deal of confusion and hurt, each of them worrying that the other had fallen out of love. Hugh had not handled it well, and Sir Gabriel had not overlooked his shoddy performance. However, after the events in January, in which he'd been beckoned to the port of Dover to help lift Audrey from suspicion of murder, everything had settled again. He was no longer in any doubt of her love for him, and he'd made sure that she was confident in his. For the last few months in London, he'd taken every opportunity, few though they'd been, to get her alone and remind her of it. He came to a stop in front of a window that overlooked Bedford Street. It wasn't a street devoted to fine residences befitting a lord, but to a mix of businesses and middle-class homes. As such, the arrival of the lady seated at his desk would have gone unnoticed by fashionable society.
"My husband would be quite cross if he knew we'd come to see you," Mrs. Silas admitted. "He would prefer to keep Bethany's absence hushed up."
"Only because Caro's husband is convinced that she has run off with this cad, this Mr. Comstock," Lady Rebecca put in. "And he cares more for a pristine reputation in Parliament than he does for his own daughter."
"Now, sister, that isn't true."
But Mrs. Silas winced and added more softly, "Not entirely." Hugh had met John Silas once. He was with the House of Commons and Hugh the House of Lords. Still, he knew the man was a serious, well-respected member of the Tories. To have rumours swirling about that his daughter had ruined herself would be detrimental to his standing, and Silas did not have a title to fall back onto. "Tell me about this Mr. Comstock," Hugh said, giving in to his curiosity. Mrs. Silas beat her fan faster.
"He is the most disgraceful of blackguards."
"What leads you to say that?"
Hugh would take her opinion with a liberal grain of salt, if only because not very long ago, he too had been branded as a blackguard. His half-brother, Bartholomew, had perpetuated a lie that had brought Hugh and his half-sister, Eloisa, to utter ruination. For years, the beau monde in London had believed Hugh had sullied his own half-sister, and his brother had happily allowed that lie to stand firm. Barty had wanted to cover up the truth, that his other brother, Thomas, was the degenerate abuser, not Hugh. The scandal had come out just over a year ago, and even with Barty's disgrace and disappearance from society, the Neatham title still suffered a black mark that would not easily scrub out. Hugh was loath to sully another man's reputation without proof. However, Mrs. Silas's lips gaped in offence at his question.
"I am led to say that because the man took my Bethany 1 week ago and never returned her."
The choice of wording set him ill at ease, as if Bethany were an object and Mr. Comstock had broken into the Silas household and stolen her. Lady Rebecca patted her sister's arm, then more calmly said,
"He is a mystery to us, Lord Neatham.
Bethany made his acquaintance at Vauxhall while she was with her friend, Miss Gwendolen Bertram, but we know very little else of him." "He claimed to be the son of a squire," Mrs. Silas said, "the late Vernon Comstock. He seemed like a dandy to Mr. Silas and me. One of the young men about town looking to catch a wife."
Hugh nodded, but also knew there were plenty of young men looking not for a wife, but only to sow their wild oats. He paced back toward his desk.
"The day she disappeared, did Mr. Comstock collect your daughter from your home, or did they meet elsewhere?"
Mrs. Silas deepened the sneer on her already pinched lips.
"He and his sister escorted Bethany on another outing to Vauxhall."
At the second mention of the pleasure gardens across the river, Hugh glanced at the clock.
In less than an hour, he would be leaving for Vauxhall himself. He was to meet Audrey there. Her mourning period had recently ended, and they'd agreed it would be a good place to make their first public appearance together. The rumours of their understanding had proliferated throughout the ton over the last few months, and Hugh was more than ready for rumour to become fact. "Vauxhall seems a natural place for a young couple to go," he said. But Mrs. Silas scoffed. "All kinds mix there." "More importantly, Lord Neatham," Lady Rebecca said with an exasperated look at her sister, "my husband has since learned that the late Vernon Comstock had one child, a son, Mr. Travis Comstock. So you see, he does not have a sister. We do not know who the young lady truly was, nor if Bethany ever arrived at the pleasure gardens. If she planned to elope, she would have packed for the travel, and yet all her belongings are still in her room. She did not take so much as a handkerchief." That bit of information struck a discordant note within him, rousing a strain of concern for the girl.
"I presume you've spoken to Bethany's friend, this Miss Bertram, to see if she knows anything of her whereabouts."
"I could not," Mrs. Silas said, her voice pitched high into a near whine. "Mr. Silas forbade me to so much as breathe a word about her being missing. Instead, he wishes to wait until she returns as Mrs. Comstock, and then smooth over the whole scandal, pretending that we knew of the discreet wedding all along."
To not post wedding bans, and to marry quickly with special license, usually indicated the need for a hasty wedding. The lady being in the family way, for instance. It was not the fashionable thing to do, but it happened, and so long as no scandal or uproar surrounded the events, it should not affect the Silas's reputations.
"And have you tried to call upon Mr. Comstock?"
It would be the first most rational thing to do. However, Mrs. Silas gasped as if horrified.
"Call on him ourselves? Of course not. Mr. Silas made inquiries in land he leases bachelor's rooms at the Chesterfield on Portman Square, but he refuses to go."
Mr. Silas likely had too much pride and couldn't stomach chasing after the man who may have ruined his daughter. Hugh returned to his chair and folded his hands on the desk. He could understand the lady's concern, and yet he could also see where the pair of lovers may have simply eloped. Who knew? This Travis Comstock may have purchased Bethany new things for their journey, rendering packing, and potentially tipping off her parents prematurely, unnecessary. Still, the twinge of doubt would not be silenced, not even when he imagined Sir Gabriel's intimidating scowl.
"Very well. I will pay Mr. Comstock's rooms a visit, and will see if I can learn anything more about him."
Lady Rebecca and Mrs. Silas both seemed to deflate with relief. He held up a hand.
"That's not to say I am taking on this investigation. I am only going to look into Mr. Comstock's whereabouts for now."
"And if you find anything of concern, what then?" Mrs. Silas asked.
He knew what he would have to do, whether he wanted to or not.
"If that is the case, I will speak to Sir Gabriel."
Lady Rebecca grinned in recognizable victory.
"Thank you, my lord."
He bristled and wondered how long it would be until being addressed as my lord didn't feel like a cat's tongue licking his skin. Lady Rebecca and her sister were moving toward the study door when Basil appeared in the threshold. To look at him, one might think he was butler of the house, dressed as he was in a fine black swallowtail coat, white waistcoat, tall stock and cravat. However, he was far too concerned with Hugh's outward appearance to be anything other than a fastidious and snobby valet. The running of the new Viscount Neatham's household was not nearly as important to Basil as the supervising of the Viscount's wardrobe. However, Basil's patience over Hugh, continuing to reside in his pre-peer status home, had ferried. After a full year of being Viscount,
Hugh knew it was time to change residence.
It is 5 o'clock,
Basil announced after the two women had exited. Mr. Whitlock, Hugh's butler, would see them out.
I am aware, Hugh said with another look at the clock.
He'd been checking it all day, eager for the evening and to see Audrey again. Basil eyed him as he approached the study door and sniffed.
You will be changing, I hope.
Hugh edged past him into the foyer of the small town home.
Would you allow me to exit this house if I did not? Heavens, no, he replied lightly,
following as Hugh ascended the stairs.
What is wrong with what I am wearing?
He asked, already shrugging out of his coat.
May I remind you that you were the one who dressed me this morning? But so much has changed since then, my lord.
Hugh rolled his eyes. Basil had been with him several years, though his decision to employ a valet had not been made entirely out of practicality. Hugh's father, the late Viscount, had left him a generous living, one a gentleman could thrive upon. After his father's death, he'd wanted to strike out on his own and prove that he did not need or depend upon the Viscount's money. However, when Hugh was tossed out of the ton for allegedly ruining Eloisa, and then when he permanently maimed Barty in a duel, he'd immediately leased a nice home and hired a small staff. He'd wanted to maintain a fragment of his respectable upbringing. Even more so, he'd wanted to prove that he was a gentleman, and not the degenerate society believed him to be.
What the devil has changed so much in the last 9 hours?
Basil rode Hugh's heels into the bedchamber and went straight to the bedside table. He picked up a small white silk box. Hugh groaned. He should have anticipated it being found and opened by his snoop of a valet.
This is what has changed, my lord.
He opened the box and held it out for Hugh to see.
I know what it is, Basil, thank you. But why would it change what I am wearing tonight?
Hugh took the box from his valet and replaced the cover. The ring inside was a small sapphire, bedded down in a pillow of silk.
It is only that if you plan to ask a certain question of a certain widow,
the valet trailed off, waving his hands in the air, as if he couldn't decide on his next words. Hugh tossed his jacket onto the bed.
I am not proposing marriage to Audrey at Vauxhall.
Basil released a breath and nearly doubled over.
Oh, thank goodness. That would have been a disaster.
He snapped up the coat and disappeared into the dressing room.
In that case, I'll just fresh you up a bit.
Hugh stared after him.
How would that be a disaster? A proposal at Vauxhall?
Basil returned with a new evening coat and a marked look of disgust.
Why not take her to a dance hall or a tavern down by the docks?
Hugh glowered as he put on his coat.
How I ask her to marry me is none of your concern.
Basil crinkled his forehead but said nothing as he brushed the shoulders and lapels of the midnight blue coat. Now that her mourning was finished, she would be free to marry again. The past year had seemed everlasting, and he'd longed for this moment. But how he would propose, what words he would say and where he would say them, were nothing he had given much thought to. He'd promised Audrey a respectable and romantic proposal. Unsurprisingly, Vauxhall did not meet those standards. Once finished, Basil stepped back to observe him.
And a walking stick, my lord?
He took up a black cane with a silver top that Hugh had not seen resting against a chair.
Have I developed a limp that I am not aware of? It is au courant. I took the liberty of ordering one from Beelman's,
Basil said as he displayed how the walking stick was to be held and used.
After he'd struck three increasingly amusing poses, Hugh held up his hands.
You may keep it.
He took up his hat and gloves from where Basil had lain them on the bed and opened the bedchamber door.
Sir!
He bellowed. The boy would not be very far, probably in the kitchen, sneaking food from the larder. Sir was waiting for him in the foyer, a crumb of some pastry still attached to his bottom lip. He now stood nearly as tall as Hugh, after having had another growth spurt, and his voice had changed over entirely. It was rather disconcerting to hear not a squeaky street urchin whenever he spoke, but a growing young man.
"We're leaving," Hugh said as Whitlock opened the door for them. "You're at the Traces."
Chapter 2 Audrey entered the western gates to the pleasure gardens, and her stomach twisted into a tight knot. The time had come. Her first public outing with Hugh was about to commence, and only 1 week since the official end of her mourning period. That day had dawned just like any other, and yet she'd risen from bed feeling lighter, freer than she had in 12 long months. The buoyant sensation had carried her through the week, toward the planned evening out. Earlier that week, Hugh had dashed a note to her, asking her to meet him at Vauxhall for dinner and entertainment. People of all classes mixed there, and they were sure to be seen together by ton, gentry, and middle class alike. The whispers about their involvement had already started to take root, but walking arm in arm around the exhibits and dining in one of the supper boxes would make their attachment formally known. The gossip sheets would be ablaze with the information. Already the columns had revisited time and again the fact that the new Viscount Neatham, one of the most eligible bachelors in London, had not attended a single soiree or ball during the season. And when Lady Veronica Kettleridge, the most stunning debutante of the last season, married an earl in early April, reminders about Lord Neatham passing her over the previous summer had resurfaced. He had, quite deliberately, not put himself into any situation that would give the matchmaking mothers of the ton any opportunity to foist their daughters onto him. In fact, he had only just attended his first dinner party a fortnight ago, at Lady Shoreham's. The Countess had encouraged Audrey to attend as a way to inch back into society, and she had accepted. Though separated by several seats at dinner, her brief conversation with Hugh in Lady Shoreham's drawing room had captured the attention of the other guests. A gossip sheet, printed the following day, remarked that perhaps the Viscount was in the market for a wife after all, but that he already had one in mind for himself and was waiting patiently for the proper time to arrive. It felt a little like a game or a show to be here tonight, on parade for all eyes to see, but there was a purpose behind it. If she was seen on the arm of the Viscount, with any hope, no other suitors would come calling at Violet House. Already that week, she'd received several bouquets of hothouse flowers from gentlemen, and it needed to reject 3 invitations to stroll or ride through Hyde Park. The men were all perfectly amiable, all titled and acquaintances of the late Duke, but to give them any hope at all would have been unkind. Besides, not one of them wanted to court her because of any real affection. She was a wealthy widow, and her estate was the main attraction. Not that she faulted any of the men for their ambitions. It was simply how the beau monde operated. After tonight, the only man who would press his suit would be the one she had, not so very long ago, believed she would never be able to have.
"I am so happy to see you out of those dreary silvers and greys," Cassie sighed as they ambled through the pavilion that fronted the orchestra box.
As it was fine May weather, the orchestra was playing in the open air rather than under the rotunda.
the soft strains of the piano and woodwind instruments carried on the gentle breeze. Audrey had cast off her widow's black while on the continent, but had returned to the more formal threads of half-mourning when she returned to London after the Dover debacle. She'd never been much for pinks or yellows or many of the other bright girlish colours, but she'd been excited to visit Madame Gascoigne in March to order several gowns in shades of blue, green and red. Her maid, Greer, had selected a promenade dress of teal silk for today, topped by a spencer of ginger gold. Much to the modiste's disappointment, Audrey did not care for the ruffles and flounces that were in fashion, but she'd consented to some cording and embroidery. She was also far too sensible to wear any of the elaborate bonnets or hats with high plumage that she saw bobbing and fluttering about in the spring breeze at the gardens. "I do feel more like myself now," Audrey replied to her sister-in-law, then winced. She was not the same woman she'd been since the last time she had gone out in London in fashionable dress. The year had changed her in several ways. Mostly, she'd struggled to come to terms with the secret she'd been entrusted with, the one she had been burdened with ever since news of her husband, Philip, the Duke of Fournier, arrived, announcing that he'd drowned at sea off the coast of Marseille. He had not drowned, however, and Audrey had been forced to uphold the charade. Instead, he had followed through with his plan to disappear into the continent with the man he loved, Mr. Frederick Walker.
"Well, you look lovely, and I meant what I said earlier. As soon as we see Hugh, I will be perfectly content to walk with Ruth," Cassie said, glancing over her shoulder to where her maid followed at a distance.
"I think you are even more eager for me to be on Hugh's arm than I am," Audrey laughed.
"Are you so tired of my company?" Cassie balked. "You know that isn't true."
"I am only jesting," Audrey replied, laughing again. It felt so good to smile, to feel light and playful. This last year, she and Cassie had grown closer than they'd been before Philip's death. Even if she'd been keeping such a large secret from her, she'd grown accustomed to the persistent feeling of guilt over Philip's brothers and sister all believing him to be dead. It had been a hard truth to accept that, to tell them now, to reveal he'd allowed them to mourn his death so that he could have the chance to live the life he wanted with the person he wanted would only more deeply injure them. For so long, she'd taken on the weight of Philip's choice, one she had been unsuccessful in persuading him to abandon. She'd held all the guilt on her own shoulders, and it had been a great effort to cast it off. In truth, she was still working toward it, and wondering if she would ever truly succeed. For now, however, she chose to think about the current moment, for that was the only thing over which she had any control. "Truthfully," she began, taking Cassie's arm into hers and lowering her voice, "I am a little nervous."
"That he will propose here at Vauxhall?" Cassie said quickly.
"I am worried too. It would be a wretched place to ask you to marry him." Audrey slowed, taken aback by Cassie's presumption. The immediate spate of apprehension surprised her. Hugh had promised her an official proposal, and a romantic one too. But suddenly, her half-boots seemed to fill with rocks, slowing her. A public proposal would be too showy, too performative. Not like Hugh at all. "He won't. Not here. Not tonight."
"Goodness, I hope not," Cassie said,
but then gave a quizzing look.
"What is it that you are nervous about, then?"
Audrey wasn't sure how to describe the persistent, restless friction that had lingered just underneath her skin all week. They passed another pair of women, strolling arm in arm. They canted their heads and smiled at Audrey and Cassie, saying a polite hello. This would be the way of their promenade this evening, and she'd best get used to it.
"It doesn't matter,"
she said once they'd strolled on.
It does, Cassie insisted.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?